Welcome back to Coffee and Capitalism Radio, heard on the Crude Life Media Network. My name is Jason Spies, and I'm your host today. In our next segment, we talk with John Nowotzky, Extension Agriculture Machine Systems Specialist at North Dakota State University.
How many farmers would you estimate are using them that you know about? Is percentage-wise, is this still relatively new?
Well, it's certainly relatively new, and I'm sure it's more like 1% or 2%. Of farmers
under five,
yeah, that I talk to. But it's amazing, you know, it's hard to tell, because up until now you had to have a commercial exemption, which was very difficult to get from FAA, and you had to have a pilot's license to fly the small ones over your own land for commercial purposes, and of course farming is a commercial activity. So farmers were reluctant to say they were using them, because it was kind of, unless they went through all those procedures, it was against regulation. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I might give a talk to a group of 100 farmers and ask them to raise their hand if they're using them, and there might be 25% of them raise their hands. But again, this is precision ag type groups, so they're more likely to be using technology maybe than other groups of farmers.
You're in front of a target market.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, target audience.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So it's impossible to know. It really is. But on the other hand, there's a lot of interest, and farmers that I talk to that use small UAVs, particularly ones that that can provide real-time video feedback, they say, you know, just they can learn so much from getting a view from up above in terms of the issues on their crops, that they once they use them, they don't want to not have them.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, there's all kinds of issues with UAVs, the quantity of the data the quantity of the data. There's so much data collected, it takes so long to process it, and it takes computer skills and computer software. And then farmers are large, and to be able to use a small UAV to collect, if you can only collect 1 square mile in an hour, and you might have fields that, you know, 30 or 40 miles apart, and it's going to take a lot of time. So I see a business opportunity for large UAVs, and in fact, that's why we're collaborating on a project that uses a large UAV that collects that same kind of imagery. Instead of 1 square mile in an hour, we'll collect 50,000 acres in one hour.
50,000 acres in an hour?
Yeah.
How far away is something like that?
Well, we're doing it now,
okay.
But we're doing it on a research project. It's not a commercial activity yet. It's the first one in the world, actually, that's doing this kind of project with a large UAV, and we expect that company really fully intends to establish a business in the Northern Plains here within the next couple of years, because they see a business opportunity where you could fly large areas and take that imagery, store it in the cloud, and let individual growers or individual agronomists clip out the imagery that they need for a certain number of dollars per acre, and they wouldn't have to do any flying. The individual wouldn't have to do any flying. The company would fly it for them, and say every 2 weeks, and mm-hmm. put that imagery, you know, in the cloud. That's our objective. That's their objective.
So the example I used to always give, I've been covering UAVs since 2007, and Tommy Kenville up at Innovation Center, and Doug Goring and I talk about them quite a bit, where you take a UAV or a drone, UAS, and you fly over sunflowers, or you fly over a roll of potatoes, and it will identify the individual disease, pathogen, or whatever might be on there, relay a message to some drone on the ground, or some robot on four wheels, drive out there and just perfume mist it, saving this farmer a small fortune on pesticides. Are we there yet, or how close are we there?
We're certainly not there yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's the goal, isn't it?
That's the goal. And I say that we're not there yet here in America. That doesn't mean that we're not there other places. There certainly is. Yamaha makes a small helicopter that can carry, 10 or 15 gallons of water or chemical. And it's used very extensively in rice fields in Japan. To actually apply herbicides. And it's completely unmanned. It takes off from a small, landing pad, goes out to the field, applies the herbicide, and comes back. Once we can get regulations set up in America that will allow us to do that, I think we're going to see a lot of unmanned aircraft use for just what you're saying, go out and fly specific areas of weeds or specific weed types. You know, I mentioned earlier that herbicide-resistant weeds are becoming a significant issue, and so they're not going to be, you know, they're going to be discovered in small areas, and the landowner or the farmer is going to want to control those right away, and so they don't go to seed and spread to others.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that, you know, it's certainly a ways off until we're going to see, you know, these drones out on, typically, you know, out on farms, but we'll see it because there's an opportunity here, there's a business opportunity, and there's payback in terms of being able to manage farms better and be more profitable.
I was going to ask you, is there a rate of return yet on these? Are they still priced a little bit more than...
Well, we, on our large UAV project that we're flying this year, that's the, one of the key objectives is the economics, the return on investment. And not only return on investment, but from the company's point of view, but from the farmer's point of view, what's the value of this image to you? You know, can you use this? And if you use it to do in-season side dressing on your corn on a variable rate, you know, how much can you save rather than putting the same rate over the whole field? So, you know, yeah, the economics is a prime objective of our projects.
To listen to the full-length interview with John Nowotzky from North Dakota State University or to listen to other Coffee and Capitalism features, visit cafecapitalism.com. That's cafecapitalism.com. My name is Jason Spies, and this is Coffee and Capitalism Radio, heard in the Crude Life Media Network.
My name is Otis, and I am the host of the Kids in Capitalism KidCast. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors. Hatch Realty is in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Call Eric Hatch or anyone on the Hatch Realty team with any real estate question. They want to be a resource and connection for you. That's Hatch Realty, 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Hatch Realty in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Hatch Realty, tell them Otis sent you.
The Real American Jam, a concert benefiting the fallen soldiers of North Dakota, July 15th, 16th, and 17th, Buffalo Gap Guest Ranch west of Medora. Joe Diffie, Corb Lund, Ned Ledoux, Bart Crow, and more will be performing. Tickets available now at realamericanjam.com. Camping's available. Call to reserve a spot, 701-623-4200. The Real American Jam, for the fallen soldiers of North Dakota, July 15th through the 17th, Buffalo Gap Guest Ranch. realamericanjam.com and buffalogapguestranch.com has complete details.
Since 1979, MBI Energy Services has committed to responsibly growing with today's oil and gas industry by providing proven experience, strategic locations, and integrated services. MBI Energy Services is well established, and its innovation in safety and excellent customer service is what truly makes MBI Energy Services the oil field service professionals. MBI Energy Services, the cutting edge in oil field safety solutions. Learn more at MBIEnergyServices.com.
Welcome back to Coffee and Capitalism Radio, heard on the Crude Life Media Network. My name is Jason Spies, and I'm your host today. Up next, barbecue tips from our company cookers.
All right, what's your name and what company are you cooking for today?
Dennis Jarrett. I cook with Steffes Corporation.
Now, are you employed with Steffes, or are you a ringer like all these other guys I'm finding out?
No, I work for Steffes.
Okay, I just did a story on Steffes about their water heaters, which PMJ has in their lobby, and so you guys are kind of revolutionizing some of the smart heaters and that sort of thing. So kudos to you guys there by being innovative in this energy world. So let's talk a little bit about smoking and cooking barbecue. So what are we cooking today?
Well, today we cooked pork butt and then pulled it. It's a pulled pork, and then we did baby back ribs.
Well, you did both. So let's start with the pork butt. Give me time and marinades and rubs and just kind of, you know, the process, what went into it.
I start with an injection, then it sits overnight, and then right before it goes on the fire, we'll put our dry rub on. And I cook it today, since we're limited on time, and I didn't feel like cooking overnight on there, we cooked it about 300 for 4 to 4.5 hours, really up to an internal temperature of about 135, 140 degrees. Then we'll pull it and wrap it for 3 to 4 hours at 300 just to finish it, and then it goes into a cooler to rest for a couple hours.
If you didn't have a time restraint, how long would the process normally take, do you think?
Typically, a pork butt that's about 7-8 pounds, you're looking at 14 hours on a regular, slow, low cook at 200 to 225.
How about the ribs? Talk to me about the process with the ribs.
Well, with the ribs, I always start with a mustard rub and let that sit. Let it sit in mustard overnight. You know, just a nice layer of mustard on top of it. Then the next, when we're ready to cook them, we'll of course put some dry rub on it. And it'll go in at about 250 for roughly 2 hours. Most of the time I do it by feel. I'll pick up the rack and how does it feel, if it's ready or not. Then we'll pull it and wrap it. And the whole time that's cooking in the smoke, we're also spritzing it about every 20 minutes, half hour with apple juice. Keep the moisture in. And after it's been on a couple hours, we'll pull it out, wrap it, put it back on the heat for a couple more hours, and then pull it and put it in the cooler to rest for at least an hour.
How about when it comes to either having a pan of water in there to kind of help with the steam and keep it moist? And also, do you use any kind of hickory or charcoal or pecan or anything?
Well, today I'm using a combination of apple and pecan. And on the pork butts, we did a little bit of hickory. Just pretty much one smoke round till it started burning out of hickory. I like the flavors of apple and pecan. Apple adds a little bit of sweetness in the smoke, and pecan's kind of a really mild, mellow smoke. And I think it just adds good. All the ribs we did today were strictly on pecan. Dennis Jarrett, I cook with Steffes Corporation.